We're looking at the third chapter of the book of Revelation in the letter to the church at Sardis. We just had one more thing to talk about there, and we really would have done better to put this in at the last of the class Tuesday, but we didn't. So we'll just touch on it today as we pass by. Revelation 3:5. He that overcometh, I guess I should push some of these things, sorry. The same shall be clothed in white raiment, and I will not blot out his name out of the book of life, but I will confess his name before my Father and before his angels. I wanted to say just a bit about the book of life because it's such an important concept in the Bible. Greek cities maintained a list of their citizens in a public register. When a citizen committed some sort of a criminal action and had been condemned for that, he lost his citizenship and his name was erased from the register. And that's exactly what's being referenced here, the spiritualizing of that concept. You could have your name on a register, your name could be erased from that register, and Paul says in Philippians 3:20, our citizenship is in heaven, from whence also we look for the Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ, who shall change our vile body, that it may be fashioned like unto his glorious body, according to the working whereby he is able even to subdue all things unto himself. In other words, we have our citizenship in heaven, but our name can be erased from the register there. Malachi talks about God's book of remembrance, and that's always a part of the concept when we refer to the book of life. Paul's fellow laborers had their names in the book of life. He wrote one time, Moses said, if you blot the names of the children of Israel out of the book of life, blot my name out too. When God was seeing if Moses would want to have a nation started but from him rather than the previous group of people, and he passed that test very well. So there are all kinds of references to the book of life. Revelation 22:19 is another reference. The main point here, though, is that it is possible to be blotted from the book of life. All the eternal security people notwithstanding, it is possible to have your name in the book of life and then have it blotted out of the book of life. But the saints who persevered would never be blotted from God's book of life. And this is the most important thing in the world. It doesn't much matter where your name is written in this world. I'm on a whole bunch of mailing lists that I just assume I wasn't even on. And if the government said, we're going to blot your name off the tax rolls, I hope they wouldn't expect me to cry about it. There's a lot of places I don't even want my name, but I want it written there in the Lamb's Book of Life. One of my favorite parts about the book of life in the Bible is later on in this same book of Revelation, Revelation 20, beginning about verse 11. I saw a great white throne and him that sat upon it, from whose face the earth and the heaven fled away, and there was found no place for them. And I saw the dead, small and great, stand before God. And the books were opened, and another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged out of the things that were written in the books according to their works. That's just a tremendous thing to think of that last day. You will be guaranteed a place with the Lord if your name is found in the book of life. Men cannot place your name there, and you are the only human being that can cause its removal. The names of those of you who overcome will not be removed from the book of life. The bottom line on Sardis is that life had been too easy for it. They had become fat and flabby, unconcerned as a city, and the church in that city had become the same way. So I want to leave you with this thought about Sardis, that you can't have a dead church when you have living people who compose that church, because the living people, with Jesus living in them, will cause the church to be other than dead. We end the letter, as most of these letters, he that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith unto the churches. By God's grace, may dead churches wake up and prepare for the coming of the Lord. Anything further that we should ask or say about the city of Sardis and the church in it and the letter written to that church? All right, sorry for the awkward break. I wish we had finished Sardis on Tuesday, but I didn't want to not cover this point. Let's go on to Philadelphia. And this is found in Revelation 3, 7 through 13. There's a picture of some of the ruins of Philadelphia. I'm going to read the letter, beginning in verse 7. And to the angel of the church in Philadelphia write, These things saith he that is holy, he that is true, he that hath the key of David, he that openeth, and no man shutteth, and shutteth, and no man openeth. I know thy works. Behold, I have set before thee an open door, and no man can shut it. For thou hast a little strength, and hast kept my word, and hast not denied my name. Behold, I will make them of the synagogue of Satan, which say they are Jews, and are not, but do lie. Behold, I will make them come and worship before thy feet, and to know that I have loved thee. Because thou hast kept the word of my patience, I will also keep thee from the hour of temptation, which shall come upon all the world to try them that dwell upon the earth. Behold, I come quickly. Hold that fast which thou hast, that no man take thy crown. Him that overcometh will I make a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go no more out. And I will write upon him the name of my God, and the name of the city of my God, which is New Jerusalem, which cometh down out of heaven from my God, and I will write upon him my new name. He that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith unto the churches. Now, Philadelphia in Pennsylvania has the same name as the city we're talking about now. You can see it boxed on the map of Asia Minor there. It's 28 miles east-southeast of Sardis. About 30 miles was a good walk in a day back in those days, and often the major towns tended to be about that far apart. Philadelphia in Pennsylvania is the fourth largest U.S. city after New York, L.A., and Chicago, and it means, of course, brotherly love. It's the city of brotherly love. In the United States, it tends to conjure up images of William Penn and the Quakers and Benjamin Franklin, and you could probably go on with a list of things that you think of about Philadelphia, the Liberty Bell, for instance. The Philadelphia to whom this letter was written is the most recently established of all the seven cities that we're studying. It was founded around 140 B.C., by a man by the name of Attalus, King Attalus II of Pergamum. Attalus was nicknamed Philadelphus because of his great love for his brother Eumenes. So this city that he founded was called Philadelphia, brotherly love, after Attalus II, who was also known as Philadelphus. We're finding that each congregation is unique. There are sample kinds of churches. Each one of the seven is a kind of a sample of kinds of churches, and all of these kinds of churches still exist now. Two of the seven that we're studying this week and last were good, and there were many others that we've been looking at. We've seen a church that fought valiantly against error and had for quite a long time. They hated evil, but they were condemned for a lack of love. We saw a church that exhibited love only to be condemned for a lack of sound doctrine and a tolerance of sin. We saw a church that was spiritually alive in every way only to be killed physically, martyred for Christ. We've seen a church that was physically alive in every way, spiritually killed by sin. We've seen a church that thought it was poor, but God said it was rich. We're going to see a church tomorrow, Lord willing, that thought it was rich, but God said it was poor, destitute of holy things. So we're seeing all kinds of churches, and our point with regard to the 21st century is that this is the way the church always is. All through the Christian era, all these kinds of churches exist. We talked about Smyrna as being one of the good ones, and now we're getting ready to talk about the other good one. And I may not have too much to say about Philadelphia because there's nothing to complain about. Usually I talk a lot longer when there's something to complain about than when there's not. In Philadelphia, we find a church that was given no rebuke by the Lord. It was a lampstand faithfully holding up the light of the Lord. Remember, that's the purpose of a lampstand. The purpose of a lampstand is not to give light. The purpose of the lampstand is to hold up the light. The light that you shine is a reflected light, reflecting the glory of the Father and the Son. I like to imagine the congregation in Philadelphia hearing this letter read for the first time, just as you heard it read. Faithful Philadelphia just simply did not need any warning or chastening or threatening, but she may not have known that as a congregation. She may have wondered about that. Probably this was not a large congregation. The town itself had few inhabitants. It had few inhabitants because it was such an unsafe place to live. And I want to tell you in a few minutes, Lord willing, why it was such an unsafe place to live. I hope to be able to explain that. But I don't know whether they originally had the entire apocalypse, the entire book of Revelation, with all seven letters included at once or not. I'm just unclear. I don't know where to find the information on that. So they may have had all the six letters. And if they were hearing these letters read in succession as we have read them, Philadelphia, as their letter was read, they may have waited for that one bad paragraph that never came. I don't know for sure how they viewed themselves, but I think I know that they had a sense of mission, a sense of purpose. They were trying to serve the Lord well, but they still may have been surprised that that one bad paragraph never came. Now, I'm saying it was probably not a large congregation because the town itself didn't have that many people living there. I'm assuming a little bit about this. This city was located on the border of three different countries, Mysia and Lydia and Phrygia. And as a border town, it was regarded as the gateway to the east. We've talked about gateway cities before. St. Louis is regarded as the gateway to the west. Ephesus was regarded as the gateway to Asia, and we talked about that last week. This was built on the edge, Philadelphia was built on the edge of a district that was called the Burnt Land, or the Burnt District, where for miles and miles and miles, a great volcano had deposited burning lava all over the place. We automatically ask why it was established there. Philadelphia was not just established because somebody thought it would be a nice place for a town, a nice, pleasant place to live. Philadelphia was established with the deliberate intention of being a missionary city for Hellenism, that is, to spread Greek language, Greek culture, the Greek way of life, and hopefully to fulfill the dream of Alexander the Great in doing so. It was established after the time of Alexander the Great, but the great dream of Alexander lingered on. According to William Ramsay, who wrote a book about the letters to the seven churches, one of the famous books about this, according to him, the success of Philadelphia in its mission is attested by the fact that before 19 BC, the native Lydian language was gone, and the Greek language was the only language in the country. I haven't been able to corroborate that from any other source, but that's what William Ramsay said. Philadelphia was regarded as the city of the open door. It was established where it was established as a missionary city. It was regarded as having an open door to spreading the Greek culture. And when the Lord says in the eighth verse that I read to you, "Behold, I have set before you an open door," he's talking to the church there, and they knew that he was spiritualizing a concept that they were familiar with on a municipal level. The Lord was taking that concept of the open door, and he was spiritualizing that. So, once again, we see a characteristic of a city in the church within that city. And we ought to look for characteristics of our culture, good and bad, in the churches that we inhabit in our day. Now, when we talked about Sardis, I mentioned the great earthquake of 17 AD. That was 2 days ago, and you've had a lot of activity, some of you, since then. So I hope you can remember back to the things we said about that earthquake in 17 AD with reference to the city of Sardis. This was the one that Pliny described as the greatest disaster in human memory, remember? Obviously, exaggerating a bit, but it shows what the scope of that earthquake must have been. There was no Richter scale in those days, obviously, so we don't have any numbers, but it must have been a remarkable thing. It devastated 12 towns in this general area, including Sardis and Philadelphia. Sardis and Philadelphia were the two cities that were nearest to the volcanic district. And while Sardis was the one that was said to have been the worst hit, Philadelphia was prominent among those whose tribute was remitted for 5 years. I said that at Sardis, and it was true here as well. The tribute or the taxation that was ordinarily paid to the Roman government was remitted. In other words, they didn't have to pay it for 5 whole years. So that's quite a substantial savings. But it was necessary if they were going to rebuild this city. But the interesting thing about this earthquake that's different from the way the earthquake affected Sardis, the interesting thing about it at Philadelphia was that the aftershocks and the tremors of this earthquake continued on for years. And you never could tell when these were going to occur. Strabo said, and we've talked about Strabo enough that I think you know who he was by now, Strabo said that Philadelphia didn't even have walls that were secure. He said, quote, "They never cease being cracked." He said they are daily shaken and split in some degree, referring to the walls of that city. He said the people continually pay attention to earth tremors and plan their buildings with this factor in mind. In other words, they knew that this shaking and aftershaking was going to continue going on, and they planned everything that they were building with that in mind. And of course, the earthquakes in this area of Turkey have been ongoing for years. They've continued right up to our own present time. It's not unusual at all to hear about an earthquake in this very area that takes many lives. In fact, not too long ago, there was one where a lot of things collapsed on top of each other, and a lot of people were injured and many were killed. Colin Hemer writes about visiting Philadelphia right after the major earthquake. And by the way, if somebody had the impression that I had been to all of these cities and also the Isle of Patmos, I hope it wasn't something I said that gave you that impression, because I certainly have not been there, although obviously it's probably obvious I would love to go. But I have not been there. But Colin Hemer wrote a book that I read about this area, and he had been there. He writes about visiting Philadelphia right after a major earthquake on March the 29th, 1969. He tells about the total collapse of a lot of the farmhouses and lots of tents that were erected for the homeless at that time by the Red Crescent. You're probably familiar with the Red Crescent. It's the equivalent, it's the branch of the Red Cross that works in Muslim countries. Obviously, you're not going to use a Red Cross in Muslim countries and have too much cooperation, so they use a Red Crescent. But there have been a lot of earthquakes in the area since the one we're talking about in 17 AD. I don't know how much I should even talk about earthquakes in Southern California. Hope it doesn't make you nervous. There are probably people here who've experienced an earthquake. How many of you have experienced, oh mercy, look at the head. Okay, who wants to share their experience? Anybody want to tell us anything that happened to you during an earthquake? Okay, Kathy. Kathy with a C. Okay. K, sorry.
It's very interesting to be in a high rise and stand in the middle of the room and literally watch the corners move in and out on the interior wall. I think that was the thing that really boggled my mind the most.
It certainly would.
Kind of scary. I was up high.
Amazing. Anybody else want to share your butch? Amazing. I just can't even imagine it. Dave.
I mean, in 1970, the Somar quake, I thought the Lord was coming.
Anybody else? Dion.
You can hear it coming.
You can hear it coming. Wow. Amazing. Janice. Dwayne.
I think they're one of one Earth's great phenomena. Just relax and enjoy.
Well, where do you want to be during an earthquake? If you're going to be where the earthquake is, where do you want to be?
I want to be in
the Well, I'm thinking I would want to be outside. Wouldn't I?
No?
What? Well, I mean, I don't want to be outside where buildings are. I want to get away, don't I? But I don't want to be in a building that might collapse on me, do I? Yeah, Peggy.
I want to be in a doorway of a well-built house.
All right. Okay. Well, a lot of you obviously have a sense of what it's like to be around during an earthquake, but bear in mind that the country and the state that you're living in has all kinds of governmental regulation regarding how we build things, because we know earthquakes are coming, we just don't know when. And so we have, I forget the acronyms of all the government agencies, but they go around and check and make sure everything's built right. There was nothing like that in the city of Philadelphia. When they knew that an earthquake was starting to happen, they would get out. They would move away, sometimes clear out of town if they possibly could, and sometimes they'd camp outside of town for extended periods of time. when the aftershocks and the tremors were continuing to occur. This is why when the Lord says to these people in the letter that I just read, you shall go no more out, in what he's giving them, to the promise to the overcomers, you shall go no more out, that meant so much to them, because they were used to having to leave on a moment's notice. They would come back, or they would stay in the area because they had this missionary spirit. Their city had been planted there for a reason. They wanted to fulfill that purpose. But they were getting tired of having to go out. And the Lord was going to arrange things so that eventually they wouldn't have to do that anymore. They'd be, if you stuck with the Lord, you'd be a pillar, a source of strength and stability, a stability that they did not physically have in this city. So a lot of them lived outside. They would farm the fertile volcanic soil that was in the area. This had just literally become a way of life for them, to seek protection out in the open air. They remained in their missionary zeal, but they were regarded by many people in the area as gamblers. Many of them were regarded as being a little touched in the head for even living there. Strabo said that one is surprised at them. I think I have that. Kind of forgot to push them. Yeah. Different parts of the city are constantly suffering damage. That's why the actual town has few inhabitants, but the majority live as farmers in the countryside as they have fertile land. But one is surprised, even at the few, that they are so fond of the place when they have such insecure dwellings. He said you're surprised at them. The main point here is that there was no security in this town of Philadelphia, but the faithful shall go no more out if they just stick with the Lord. He's not speaking physically, he's talking in spiritual terms. They shall go no more out was a wonderful way of expressing the eternal security of one who has been faithful to the end. Now, it's also interesting to notice that the name of this town was changed more than once. The citizens were so grateful that Tiberius remitted their taxes and gave them money in addition to the tax remittance that in gratitude to him, the city was changed to the name of Neo Caesarea. And sometimes in the literature we find it referred to in this way, rather than being called Philadelphia. At a later time, it was changed to Flavia after Vespasian, because Vespasian was of the Flavian family, and evidently he'd done something that they liked in Philadelphia. We're unclear on what it was. In 2004, we're not able to find that. At least I haven't been able to find what Vespasian did for them, but if I had to guess, I'd say that he may have bailed them out after a similar disaster to the one we've been describing. So the point here is that it was a new city with a new name to honor the divine emperor, divine in quotation marks, because since Julius Caesar and Augustus, the emperors had been regarded as divine, and they were to be worshipped, to honor the divine emperor whose patronage had restored it. Now, with that little background, I think we're in a place where we can look at the letter, beginning in verse 7. The description of the Lord here is not drawn from chapter 1. That makes it unusual among these seven letters. Rather, it's a very Hebrew description of the Lord, a very Old Testament type description of the Lord. He says that the Lord is holy, hagios, set apart, different. It's the idea of sanctification, and the same thing applies to us. If you are a sanctified person, you're God's person, set apart for God, consecrated, reserved for God, you belong to him. He is the one who is holy. He's different. Also, the word true is used here, and the word true as used, the original word means real or genuine. Not just true as opposed to false, but genuine or real as opposed to unreal. Like Plato's perfect world, where everything was the perfect and the ideal, and everything we have in this world was just a pale copy, a pale imperfect copy of Plato's ideal world. The chair was used as an illustration of that. Somewhere is the perfect chair. Every chair that we've got is just an imperfect or pale copy of that. It's that same idea. Jesus says, I am the truth, and that's the concept here. He was all that a real or genuine man could be expected to be, because Jesus did remain man after he left here, right? He became man, But he never stopped being man. And years after he'd already ascended to his Father's right hand, the Apostle Paul would write and say that there is one God and one mediator between God and men, the man, Christ Jesus. That must have been around 30 years in 1 Timothy 2. Must have been around 30 years after Jesus had already ascended, but he was still a man. He's still human and still, of course, fully divine as well. But he's human. We have not a high priest which cannot be touched with the feeling of our infirmities, but was in all points tempted like as we are, yet without sin. And he remains human. He remains fully cognizant of what it is to be human. So he's true or real. All that a real man could be expected to be. I don't know who your ideal of a real man is. Could be John Wayne. Could be the governor of California. Could be anybody. But God's idea of a real man is Jesus Christ. Jesus is holy and true. He's different and real. He has the key of David. Anywhere we read about a key in symbolic language, we're referring to authority. It's the symbol of authority to unlock. I've got a key from my pocket here, which is the authority to go out and open up my car, drive my car away. If I give you this key, that's tacit permission to go use it, do something with it. Because it's the symbol of authority. And that's what it is here. He has the authority of David's throne. And I think that's pretty straightforward. The keys of the kingdom were the authority to open up the kingdom to men when they were given to Peter by the Lord in Matthew 19. And then in verse 8, he makes that statement about the open door. You're living in a city that is the city of the open door in Philadelphia. Behold, I set before you, spiritually speaking, to the church, I set before you an open door to take the gospel to the heathen. As a city, you have an open door to take Greek culture. And I'm giving you an open door to take the gospel to the heathen. This is a very familiar symbol, biblically speaking. A door is the symbol of opportunity. An open door is a symbol of an opportunity that is present, that exists right now while the door is open. There is a great door and effectual open unto me, Paul said in the 1 Corinthians letter 16:9, and there are many adversaries, but there is an open door. So a shut door would be the opposite of that, an opportunity that used to exist but is now past. When Noah got all those animals into the ark and he got his family in there, God shut the door. There was no longer an opportunity to enter it. And the parable of the 10 virgins gives us the same kind of an idea. 5 of them were wise and 5 were otherwise. You know the story so well I won't repeat it to you. But when the 5 got back from purchasing the oil, first of all it says when the bridegroom came, they that were ready. That's such a tremendous phrase. They that were ready entered into the marriage feast with the bridegroom. And when the 5 got back who had not been ready, they found that the door was shut, and even though they pounded on it, they were not allowed admission to the feast because it was an opportunity, but it was passed. The door was shut. Every time we have this open or shut door terminology, it seems to have the same basic meaning. I am he that openeth, and no man shutteth, and shutteth, and no man openeth. When the Lord wants you to have an opportunity, he's providentially going to find a way for that opportunity to exist. And when he doesn't want that particular opportunity, he will providentially find ways to shut off that. And this is true evangelistically speaking. We don't always understand everything that's going on there, but I personally believe that God works providentially in this. This is probably one of the main areas that he works in. When that Ethiopian was going along the highway in that chariot reading what we call the 53rd chapter of Isaiah, and he didn't understand it, he was a sincere seeker, and God arranged, and by miraculous means on that occasion, God arranged to get an explainer of that text to him. I think it's very likely he'll do that for any sincere seeker, maybe not miraculously, but definitely providentially in our time. Get them into some kind of a situation. Maybe they see a VBS ad in a pamphlet that's passed out in the neighborhood, and they show up at the door. But sin seekers, love will find a way, and the Lord is going to find those who love the truth and help them to find the truth. That's what I believe. And I think this open door is about that type of thing. He's going to give them an open door for evangelism to find the sincere seekers after truth. Here's his commendation of them. Thou hast a little strength. Now, I have heard the church at Thyatira condemned because it's been said by some people, well, they could have had more strength. They just had a little strength, and it could have been said that they had more strength if they had. So they weren't everything they should have been. I don't look at it that way at all. Thou hast a little strength. I looked at this as a congregation that was laboring against the odds. they had a little strength, and it was good that they did. They may have been very small, but they were mighty in the eyes of the Lord. Never worry because your congregation is small. There are people here from very small congregations. I don't think you ever ought to worry about that. As long as you know that you're doing everything you're supposed to do to get the word out, don't worry about the size of your congregation. Jesus said, "Fear not, little flock." And he's with you if you're with him. He's with you in that. Paul said, "When I am weak, then I am strong." 2 Corinthians 12, verse 9. You have kept my word. I can't find a better commendation for a congregation than that. You have kept my word. They were obedient to the word of the Lord. How can you do better than that? You have not denied my name. They were loyal to him. This is the perseverance of the saints from chapter 14, verse 12. This is the perseverance of the saints. When you don't deny his name, when you show the fidelity, the loyalty that we ought to show, then you're qualifying to become that pillar. In verse 10, he says, "Thou hast kept the word of my patience." Now that's endurance. They endured steadfastly, instant, in season, out of season, through good times and bad. The Lord says, "You've done it the way that I did it. You kept the word of my patience." The Lord's patience is the way he manifested patience. You followed my command and you followed my example. He goes on in verse 9 and talks once again about the synagogue of Satan. Now, when we were talking about the church at Smyrna and a letter written to them, we talked about the synagogue of Satan already, and I don't intend to repeat everything that was said then unless somebody just wants to. But it's the idea of the synagogue of Satan, as I view it, versus the synagogue of God. Synagogue of God is actually a phrase that's used in Psalm 74, verse 8. It's the idea of who the true Jews are as God looks at the world in the Christian era. And he gives us a good hint about that in the latter part of the second chapter of the Roman letter. He is not a Jew who is one outwardly. In other words, having the right mark of circumcision, having the right ancestry that can be traced back. He is not a Jew who is one outwardly, but he is a Jew who is one inwardly. I don't know how it can be any clearer than that. We talked about the synagogue of Satan before, and I don't want to dwell on it here. We don't know much about the Jews in the city of Philadelphia during this time period. We said 2 days ago that neighboring Sardis had a great synagogue there. I showed you a couple pictures of the reconstructed synagogue at Sardis, and it was evidently a great center of the diaspora, which is the way I've always pronounced that word until I heard Charles last hour pronounce it a different way. And I don't know what's the right way to pronounce it, but I hope you know what I'm talking about. The great scattering of the Jews is... Okay, I guess that means we ought to move on. Let's try to get someplace where we know what we're talking about. It's likely that Philadelphia, with its turbulent circumstances, offered economic opportunities. And the Jews, through the years, let's face it, I don't want to be placing people in a categorized box here, but through the years, they have been very famous for taking advantage of opportunities to make money. And I don't think that's anything for them to be ashamed of as a people. Back in Deuteronomy, the Lord told them, "I will give thee power to get wealth," and he certainly did. And they've been very good at that through the years. And I think it's likely that Philadelphia, with its very turbulent circumstances, which we've described because of the earthquake, continually occurring tremors and aftershocks, it probably offered economic opportunities for instance, the selling of necessities at exorbitant prices. And the Jews may have moved in and been involved in that. That's just a thought. It's just a possibility. The Lord provoked the Jews to jealousy through the Gentiles. The main point that's being said here is, while there is a synagogue of Satan among you, because there's just one Israel of God, Galatians 6:16, in the Christian era, there's just one Israel of God. And the church is the Israel of God. I don't know how else to take Galatians 6:16. Any other Israel is not the Israel of God as God looks at it. So I think that's what he's referring to here. People who ancestrally have been regarded as Jews, but they're a synagogue of Satan because since the cross and their rejection of the Messiah, they became just as satanic as the Caesar worship of the pagans. There was satanic involvement in both of those. His point here is that they will bow down at your feet, not in worshiping the Christians, but they will bow down and worship God at the feet of the Christians. That was going to happen at some time in the future. There is a future time coming when every knee shall bow and every tongue shall confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of the Father, Philippians chapter 2. The honor and respect shown by a humbled, defeated enemy. Seems to me that this church came about as close as you can to being all that the Lord wants in a church. I find no fault in it because I don't think the Lord found any fault in it. In verse 10, he notice here that the word kept and the word keep appear very often close together. The keepers are the kept. Because you have kept my word, I will keep you from the hour of trial. That is, from the future test. There are some classes that you might take in school, and this would especially tend to happen in college, I think. There would be some classes that you might take that if you're a good student and you've already demonstrated that, you might even be allowed to skip the final for that class. You might be allowed to skip the final test because there's nothing left for you to prove. You've already demonstrated your proficiency in the subject, and I think I had classes where you didn't have to take the final if you did well enough through the semester. Because the test exposes you for what you are. If you've already made clear what you are, then you don't have to take that final test. These people had already made clear what they were, and they were going to be reprieved from some final trial. Now, I'm not sure what he's talking about here as a trial, but they were going to be kept from something that was to come in what at that time was the future. Behold, I come quickly, he says. I come quickly in this trial is probably what he's talking about. And we have to bear in mind here that when we find the Lord talking about coming, that's not always the same as an appearance of Christ. There are at least two main appearances of Christ. He appeared the first time at the end of the ninth chapter of the Hebrew letter. This is talked about. He appeared the first time and had the public ministry that we all know fairly well from the Gospels. And then he will appear again the second time in his final coming. Every coming of Christ is an appearance of Christ, but not every appearance of Christ is necessarily... Every appearance of Christ is a coming of Christ, but not every coming of Christ is necessarily an appearance of Christ. There are all kinds of comings of Christ in the Bible. He said one time, I think it was Matthew 10:23, you shall not have gone over the cities of Israel. He told his disciples, you shall not have gone over the cities of Israel until the Son of Man become. Well, what does he mean there? It may have been something as simple as, you're not going to get through all these cities until I catch up with you, until the Son of Man become. That was a coming of Christ. The destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD was definitely referred to as a coming of Christ, but it wasn't an appearance of Christ in the same way that what we call the second coming is going to be. What I'm saying is there's nothing about a coming, I come quickly, that tells us that it's the end of time. We don't know definitely what he's talking about here. I think he's probably referring to whatever trial he referenced in the previous verse. It's something that's vague enough that it doesn't tell us definitely when it is. There was going to be something that was going to occur, and he was going to be with them in it and keep them from the problems of it. Hold that fast which thou hast, and no man take thy crown, he says. Let no man take thy crown in verse 11. How would they take your crown? They would take your crown by causing you to leave the faith. If you got so discouraged or so frightened and left the faith, then in that sense, whoever caused that discouragement or that frightening would be taking your crown. Because remember, only saints who are faithful to the end are going to be saved. The crown of life, meaning the crown which is life, as I understand it, and I've put some other references there that have to do with that same thing, but I think somebody else covered this, and maybe John talked about this in class, maybe not, I don't know who it was, but somebody had some stuff up there about the crown. So it may not be necessary for us to go over that again. And by the way, this is an athlete's victory crown. We're not talking about the diadem, which the king would wear. We're talking about the stephanos, which was a laurel wreath that, maybe it was Tom Woody that talked about this, a laurel wreath that was given as a victory crown. In Philadelphia, games and festivals were especially prominent on its inscriptions. They exemplify, at Philadelphia, with an unusual clarity, the importance attached to athletic prowess in that city, and in these cities generally. The stadium site at the city of Philadelphia can still be seen. And if I was good at PowerPoint, I'd have a picture to show you of it, but I wasn't able to get one or even find the right link for it. But it can still be seen at the city of Philadelphia. He says in verse 12, if you're an overcomer, I will make you a pillar in the temple of my God. Again, this is stability, it's firmness, it's support. They never knew when the quakes would come. They lived in the dread of disaster, but the time was coming when they would go no more out, and earthquakes and aftershocks and tremors and camping outside of the city would be over. They would dwell in security with the Lord. Incidentally, I think it's worth stating as we pass by. Sorry, I didn't click it right, I think. I want to mention about the pillars and the temples that they supported. Asian temples were built a little differently than temples in some other places because they were built to withstand severe earthquakes. At least the later ones were after they got used. They didn't have these precautions in building housing for the people. But a temple, now that was the dwelling place of a god, so they built that more securely and more firmly. Their foundations were laid on beds of charcoal that were covered with wool fleeces, which caused the structure to float on that wool and on that charcoal, sort of like a raft would float on the ocean and go up and down with the waves, so that those waves that Butch was talking about that he watched go down a street in San Jose, the temples in Asia in these later times were built so that they could withstand a certain amount of that. Now, not if it got too bad, they couldn't withstand it. But they could withstand a certain amount of that. Each block was joined to the others by metal clamps so that the platform was a unity. And the point is that the temple would be the most secure structure in the city. The promise to be a pillar in the temple of God was one of security and safety. In this city of brotherly love, apparently the church was living up to the name of the city. The church is the pillar and ground, or the pillar and support of the truth, as Paul put it to Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 3, about the 15th verse or so there. The church, the pillar and support of the truth. In other words, it holds up the truth, just as the lampstand holds up the light so it can shine. So the pillar and support of the truth holds up the truth. The church holds up the truth. The church holds up the light. And by the way, inscribed pillars are found throughout Aegean Turkey. There's a couple of books by George Bean, who was an archaeologist who did a great deal, spent his career in this area working these sites, that talk about that in some detail. Inscribed pillars are found throughout this area. And reference is seen also here to Old Testament pillars like Jachin and Boaz that stood out in front of Solomon's temple. Those can be referenced here as well. 1 Kings 7:21 would be the reference for that. Jesus will write divine names as well as his new name on those human pillars who overcome. That's the main point. And also, the city of my God. This would call to mind the names that were assumed by Philadelphia in honor of the various imperial benefactors, Tiberius and Vespasian, who it was called Flavia after Vespasian because he was of the Flavian family. I hope you remember when Mr. Steve Martin was leading songs about heaven the other night, and he had Ben Fry, thank you. You do remember. He had Ben Fry read a portion of the 21st chapter of the book of Revelation. That would be a very pertinent reading right here at this time, because it's a contrast, a stark contrast. The city of my God is a stark contrast to what we're reading about here in Philadelphia. You take the symmetrical beauty of that heavenly city, which is as long as it is wide, but it's also as high as it is wide and long, whatever that means, and I've got all kinds of ideas about what it may mean, but they'd just be speculation. Whatever that means, there's a beautiful symmetry to that. And you contrast that beautiful symmetry of the heavenly city with the wrecked and neglected buildings of the existing shaky city of Philadelphia when they got this letter, then it's quite a contrast, and I think must have directly given comfort to these people who were somewhat besieged and maybe a little beleaguered. Writing the name of the city on you represents your citizenship. I already quoted from Philippians 3, but it is so pertinent here. Our citizenship is in heaven. Paul's not playing word games. He's not being cute when he says that. He means it. He means that absolutely and truly. Our citizenship is in heaven, from whence also we look for the Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ. God has honored you. You have citizenship in the greatest city there is. And I don't mean West Covina. You have citizenship in the greatest city there is. And you ought to think of yourself that way. God has placed you in this honored position. And maybe it helps us to behave a little differently when we know how God has honored us. The security of the heavenly city stood against the precariousness of life in Philadelphia. Philadelphia received a new name twice in the first century, and Jesus will write his name on those who are the property of Jesus, as the t-shirt Charles showed on. I think it was Charles that showed a t-shirt that said property of Jesus. That wasn't you? Well, I forget. Somebody showed a, I was sitting right in front of it, they showed a property of Jesus t-shirt there, which caught my eye. Because that could well be a description of you. Property of Jesus. It means you're identified with him. We live in a shaky, unsure world, change and decay, and all around I see. O thou who changest not, abide with me. There's no variableness. There's neither any shadow as though cast by turning with him. He is the one who said, I am Jehovah, I change not. And we're told in Hebrews, Jesus Christ, the same yesterday, today, and forever. He is our eternal reference point. And no matter how shaky things get here, physically, spiritually, or otherwise, he remains our eternal reference point. Anybody got anything to say about the letter to the church in Philadelphia? Steve, sorry. Okay. Not necessarily.
In Revelation, the 22nd chapter, would the same be true? Because in that chapter, the last chapter of the Bible, it mentions at least three times, behold, I come quickly, and it's kind of in the same context as
right.
The king.
Right.
It's encouraging us to take part of the water of life.
Right.
Really.
In chapter 22, the context says to me that it's probably referring to the end of time. Because he spent two chapters there talking about the heavenly city, and in the historical flow of things, he's already come down to the end of time. So I think in context that fits there. But in the letter to Philadelphia, we're still in the first century, and he's talking about things that seem to be in rather direct connection with the context of their time there. And I think the expression, I come quickly, is broad enough, or vague enough, to cover both types of things. So I appreciate you helping me make that point. Thank you, Steve. There was another one I thought. Jerry.
The synagogue of Satan could be applied to the Jewish faith today.
It could. That's very true. It certainly could be. And as is the case in many instances, we want to distinguish between certain individuals that we may know and communities or movements or forces as a group sometimes. All of us know some wonderful people who are of a Jewish ancestry, and some of these people are our friends, and many of them are caught up in a system which they themselves don't fully understand, and indeed in many cases have made very little effort to understand. It's just a sort of a historical heritage to them or for them. So it behooves us to do everything we can to try to share the gospel with them in a way that will be meaningful for them. It could be. There's a difference between the system and being a slave of the system. Not that both won't eventually have the same end, but there's a difference in our approach when we are dealing with some sort of a monolithic system as opposing to somebody who has been caught up within that system like maybe that ram was caught up in the thicket by its horns so that Abraham could capture it and sacrifice it. that Ram was not necessarily a willing participant in that process. He was just caught. And there are a lot of people just caught in these religious systems all about them. So we ought not necessarily think of all of them as the enemy. They may or may not be the enemy. It's going to depend on their attitude more than anything else. You make an excellent point, Jerry. Thank you. I was thinking there was one more. Hey, John.
On that phrase, I come quickly.
Yes.
Be in some way a reference to how he was going to come rather than
when. It certainly could. Certainly could. Either way, it wouldn't define just what it was he was coming in. Every time the Lord comes, it doesn't mean that he shows up so that you can see him personally. He didn't, like we have in the 10th chapter of Hebrews, that how was that put there? So much the more as we see the day approaching. He that shall come will come. He that shall come will come. Well, who was coming? Titus was coming, but yet it was described elsewhere as a coming of Christ. Any other questions or thoughts? David.
Just a point of reference, I don't know if anybody else has heard of this. We had a group contact us in Michigan. They refer to themselves as the New Philadelphians. The name of their organization.
Yes, I think I've heard of them before. They've been around for a little while. Thank you. Anybody else? All right. Janice, go ahead. Yes.
When I had read that before, I thought of that as maybe being a comment that somebody could use a little more strength, maybe. Because he doesn't say you have great strength.
Yeah.
I think you have a good level of strength, you think you have little strength.
Yeah.
And yet they had not united in names, but it doesn't say they've done really good things either, like spreading the gospel or something like that. And I wonder if maybe some of us,
okay. Thank you. I think he's commending them, definitely commending them. They've put up with an awful lot through severe circumstances. But everybody can do better. Dion, was it you or Tina? I couldn't tell. Go ahead. That's true.
Think about
earthquakes
back then.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I come from a state, we had an earthquake in 1811 that sent the Mississippi River flowing backwards, if you can imagine that. So we've got them there, too, and who knows? We may have a huge one in the future. They're all around the world. We're more aware of them now than we used to be because of our technology and media resources. But they've always been happening. Ken. Good for you. I'm glad you're not worried. We're going to have to begin to take our lunch break here, but we may have some announcements. Anybody got announcements? Lord willing, tomorrow.